This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy, sitting in for Bill Radke. King County Sheriff John Urquhart told his officers not to record a rape allegation against him. That came to light in documents filed for an unrelated lawsuit. Seattle Times reporter Lewis Cam wrote about it in today's paper. Cam told me a former deputy came forward to the FBI earlier this year accusing the sheriff of raping her in 2002.
And the FBI took a look at that and shared some information with the King County Sheriff's Office through its internal investigations unit. And what the investigators in the unit have since testified to in a deposition is that they took the matter to the sheriff and asked if he would like this documented per department protocol in the sheriff's office complaint tracking system. And he told them he did not want it documented. So essentially the kind of from a journalistic point of view, we felt the importance of the story was the fact that not necessarily the veracity of whether or not this allegation is true, but how the sheriff's office decided to handle it.
Why do you think Sheriff Urquhart decided not to have this complaint documented?
I can't say one way or the other. I'm not going to say what my thoughts are. I just what he has, put in statements to the court and filed during his own deposition is that that the allegation just wasn't credible. He knows it to be false, and B, the FBI took a look at this and found it not credible. So there has been an investigation. And then the last thing is that, the complaint didn't come directly to his department, so there would be no reason for him to document it. And he also expressed that he had some worries about not only his reputation, but the reputation of the woman who has had some history with mental illness.
Just so that we're clear, is there protocol in place that shows that this should have been documented at some level within the sheriff's department?
Well, when I was looking at it and wondering that, I relied upon a few things. There's testimony provided in the court records by both of the internal investigators who received this information from the FBI. Under questioning, they said, yes, we believe this should have been either documented or investigated even more fully. When you look at the sheriff's general orders manual, which is essentially the rule book or the department's law for the sheriff's office, there is a section on how internal investigations work. And it, by looking at it and talking with some folks familiar with it, there is sections within it that seem to indicate that when you get a serious complaint of misconduct, at the very least, you're documenting it into the department system. And then from there, you determine, how you handle it, whether it gets a kind of a cursory look or a kind of fuller investigation.
I did read through some of the depositions that were published along with your stories. It was quite clear that the people who received this information were not happy to be dealing with it. What does that say about something like this?
I don't want to interject my own thoughts about it. What I know from my reporting and looking at the same depositions that you looked at was that, it sounds as if one of the captains, in particular Captain Jesse Anderson, who was the commander of the Internal Investigations Unit, expressed some reluctance or I don't know what you would say, hesitancy about this whole thing because, it puts them in a tricky spot, right? So there's a very serious allegation coming forward about your boss. And at the same time, he's your boss. So are you supposed to investigate it? Are you supposed to follow his instruction? What are you supposed to do? So it kind of puts them in a very tricky spot, I think. And that's what he seemed to be reflecting in his comments.
These allegations against Sheriff Urquhart and his actions to stop the internal reporting of them came to light as part of a bigger ongoing case. Tell me about that.
That's right. And I should say that the sheriff has said in statements or you know, when he's when I've been in touch with his office, that he feels like this was just orchestrated out of this lawsuit. The lawsuit is essentially there's three deputies that have sued King County, alleging that the sheriff's office is engaged in a pattern and practice of discriminating against female officers and retaliating against deputies who complain. So this is an ongoing lawsuit that's been going on for about a year. And as part of this, the plaintiffs are, you know, offering some examples of how this is a wider practice or how there's more going on. And the allegations are that under the sheriff and his direction that he's using maybe the Internal Investigations Unit as a means to retaliate and to settle personal scores.
What do you hope people take away from this article today?
Well, I got to say this was a very tricky and you know, sensitive article to write, because anytime you're getting an allegation that essentially boils down to a he said, she said, that's typically very difficult to really report on. But what I think was important about this story that rose it to the level of actually, you know, publishing a story about, was the fact that how the sheriff purportedly told his investigators to handle this complaint. And actually, there was more than one complaint that made an allegation of sexual contact between the woman and the sheriff. One of them suggested that there had been an affair, and the other one was the woman's claim that came through the FBI contacting the sheriff's office. So I think what's important is, you know, Sheriff Urquhart has always been very vocal about bringing accountability to the sheriff's office, and you know, it sounds like through this case that some of his own deputies are now questioning whether that's a genuine concern of his or whether he's using the department to settle personal scores or do what he wants.
Seattle Times reporter Lewis Kam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We reached out to Sheriff Urquhart today. He was unavailable for comment, but his office did send the following statement. The sheriff's office has already provided a tremendous amount of information in writing to the Seattle Times and other media outlets, and we have responded to false allegations in court filings. A spokesman for the office also said the allegations were raised in an ongoing lawsuit, and the sheriff did not intend to try the case through the media. Along with reading, writing, and math, many schools are trying to focus more on what are known as soft skills, like how to get along with other people and talk about your feelings. In some Seattle area classrooms, special teachers are helping with these lessons. They're babies. KUOW education reporter Ann Dornfeld has our story.
It's not every teacher who wears a onesie and a diaper and gets greeted with a song.
Hello, baby Declan, how are you? How are you today?
A room full of smiling second graders welcome five-month-old baby Declan to his monthly visit to Highland Terrace Elementary. The students settle into a circle on the floor. Their eyes are glued to their tiny guest. These visits are part of Roots of Empathy. It's an international program that brings babies to classrooms to help students think more about other people's emotions and their own. Roots of Empathy instructor Rebecca Young asks the class to pay attention to Declan's body language.
Tell me how you think he's feeling, Mandy.
What tells you that?
Luke.
his expression on his face.
He's smiling right now.
He's smiling right now. Thank you.
He's trying to catch my head.
The children note that Declan's legs are much stronger than last month, and his hands are opening up. No more clenched fists. Young asked the class how they'd characterize Declan's general disposition.
He seems pretty sunny, doesn't he? In this room, how many of you feel that you're sort of high on the sunny mood Let me see, show of hands. Okay, so quite a few of you. And what about those of you who feel like you're just a little more serious in your mood? Okay, and I've got a couple of you. That's a temperament trait, just like activity level. And we can see that this guy is quite active.
Yes, he's quite active.
Declan's mother, Jill Mitchell, shows the students what's in her diaper bag and how she knows what he wants at any given time, from a fresh diaper to a pacifier.
Let's sing a song to our bouncy baby. Maybe, how about a bouncing song? And we'll see how he... Do you think he wants us to sing to him?
Yeah.
Roots of Empathy has been shown in numerous studies to increase students' compassion toward their peers and to reduce aggression. The program began in Canada. Over the past two decades, it's expanded to 10 countries and 3 languages. Young says she became an instructor for the program after seeing its effect on her own young son.
He's really empathic, and I think he got that so early on, it stayed with him.
In between visits from Declan, Young comes to the class to talk about feelings and to help students do art projects and other lessons to explore the highs and lows they experience themselves. Whitney Burgett teaches the second grade class. She says in the few months baby Declan has been coming, she's already seen students treating each other more gently and cooperatively. Burgett says being able to experience feelings along with a baby makes all the difference for kids.
They're able to see this in a different person that's not somebody else in the classroom. It's not them, but they're taking what they're learning about the baby and putting it into their own lives.
Highland Terrace principal Jacqueline Estefan says she's really happy with a strategy to put Roots of Empathy into every second grade classroom in the school this year.
All the reading that I'm doing around how can we make our schools a safe place for children is all about the proactive and the preventative approaches. And so that's what Roots of Empathy is.
Back in the classroom, baby Declan is wilting a little bit.
What do you think he's telling us?
You.
Yeah, Elena.
He's tired.
How did you know he's tired?
Because he put his head down.
He put his head down.
These second graders will see their baby again in a month. In the meantime, he'll be on their minds. In Shoreline, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
Goodbye, baby Declan. See you soon. See you soon. See you soon.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy, sitting in for Bill Radke. Parts of the Affordable Care Act may stay in place, though President-elect Donald Trump had said he will get rid of the program. And Washington's U.S. Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers says congressional Republicans plan to act soon. Steve Jackson of Spokane Public Radio reports.
Now the Republicans will actually have the numbers to do away with Obamacare, McMorris Rogers says some provisions of the landmark law will likely be spared.
There's always been broad support around the kids up to age 26 that want to stay on their parents' plan, being able to do so. Also, pre-existing conditions. Those that have pre-existing conditions need to be assured that they will have access to health insurance plans that will best meet their needs.
The Eastern Washington Republican has been critical of the ACA, even when large numbers of low-income residents in her district signed up for coverage. McMorris Rogers says those people should not be afraid they'll be left in the lurch when Congress reconvenes in January.
Whatever happens, there's going to be a transition so that everyone can have that confidence that there's not going to be a cliff where they one day have health insurance and then they don't.
She also says it's time lawmakers have a serious debate about the future of Medicare.
The average couple will pay about $100,000 into Medicare in the course of their lifetime, and they are pulling out $250,000 worth of benefits. And I think anyone understands that that is not sustainable. So we need to make sure that we are taking steps now to secure Medicare and make sure that it is in a position where both current and future generations will know the commitment and will be able to ensure that Medicare is there for them.
House Speaker Paul Ryan is proposing Medicare reform that includes Medicare exchanges, where private insurance companies would compete with traditional government-run Medicare for customers. Ryan has argued that Medicare is going broke because of Obamacare, but this year's Medicare Trustees Report says the program would now be able to pay all its bills through 2028, a full 11 years longer than a 2009 forecast. They attribute that in part to changes in Medicare called for in the Affordable Care Act. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy and for Bill Radke. For more than half her life, NPR's Diane Rehm knew herself by her relationship with one person, her husband, John. Then John Rehm was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. About 2 years ago, after several years of declining health, John Rehm chose to end his life. He stopped eating, he stopped drinking and taking his medication, and after 10 days, he died.
And those were the loneliest 10 days of my life. Lying there next to him, sitting next to him, watching him slowly disappear.
John's illness and death forced Diane to rethink who she was, an investigation she writes about in her book, On My Own. Diane Rehm told Jeannie Yandel how the bed she shared with her husband helped her accept what it means to be alone.
For 54 years, I had slept on one side of the bed, and his pillows were on the other side of the bed. And I think it was about 10 days after his memorial service, I put my little dog, Maxie, up on the bed, as we always did, and I looked at the pillow on my side of the bed, and I thought, you know what? It's time to move to the center of the bed. It sort of felt as though it was time to recognize that I was alone in that bed and not sharing that bed with anybody else. So I moved the pillows to the center of the bed. And of course, I was awake all night. It really was a major, major move. And I guess I hadn't recognized how major it was going to be.
You said you didn't realize how major of a move it would be to go to the center of the bed. When did it hit you that this was a major thing?
As I lay there trying to sleep through the night. I mean, I recognized that his death was final, that I was alone, that this was now my bed, but in my heart, it will always be our bed. So, you know, lots of people, Jeannie, talk about the idea of closure, something, frankly, I don't believe in. I think when we lose someone we love and someone we've spent more than half our lifetimes with, there is no such thing as closure. I think I will, in one way or another, be grieving for the rest of my life. But I'm still sleeping in the center of the bed.
Well, one of the things you keep coming back to in the book is who you were as John Rehm's wife. How did your husband shape your identity when the two of you were married?
Oh my gosh, in such magnificent ways. He was the first person in my life, Jeannie, and I say this without any hesitation. He was the first person to say to me, "You can do anything you want to do." Now, I know lots of children these days hear that from parents. I did not. But John gave me that confidence, that support, that understanding. I mean, I could ask him anything. He was truly what we call today a Renaissance man. He was a Greek and Latin major scholar in college, but then because he realized he had earned a living, he went on to law school and became an attorney first on Wall Street, and then because he didn't like the atmosphere there, came to Washington, D.C. But I could ask him anything about music, about art, about literature, about politics, about government, and he always could help me understand. And when I began my volunteer work at WAMU, I know how shocking this sounds, but on the first day I volunteered and came home just filled with excitement and, oh my gosh, I was so happy. He looked at me and he said, "Someday you'll be host of that show." And I said, "John Rame, give me a break. You know, I'm just starting as a volunteer. Just let me be a volunteer. Don't think about what comes next." But he did. He had such confidence in me. It was extraordinary. So he gave me a great deal.
I have to say, it sounds like he had such confidence in you, you almost had no choice but to believe he was right.
I did believe him, and yet I had great doubts about myself. And those doubts continued for quite a while, even after I became the host of what was then Kaleidoscope, and later in 1984 became the Diane Rehm Show. I had huge doubts. I think you either have that confidence from a very young age or you have great doubts. And my doubts kind of fed on themselves. And John Rehm really helped me to get through that.
Well, now that you are alone, what does that mean to you? What does that word alone mean to you?
It means that I love my friends. My children each have their own lives, their own families. I have my dog. I go out as much or as little as I choose. And my friends understand when I say I really need to be by myself, because I have a fairly public life, and therefore I need to sort of regroup. I need to have that time alone, which I never appreciated before because there was somebody always around. But now alone means standing on my own 2 feet. And now that there's just Maxie, my little dog, and me, I value that time alone so incredibly much. It's really quite a change because John was the one who said that silence for him was like a glass of cool water. I've come to understand finally what he means.
Diane Rehm has hosted the Diane Rehm Show on public radio since 1984. She'll host her final broadcast tomorrow. Then she'll advocate for right to die laws around the country. This is The Record. When you're a teenager, between school and figuring out who you are, there's a lot of pressure. Marlo Mack has been thinking about this a lot lately. She's the single mom of an 8-year-old transgender daughter, and puberty is just a few years away.
Do you know what a teenager is?
I remember being a teenage girl.
Describe some of the teenagers you know.
They're always worrying about their clothes.
And let's just say it wasn't an experience I'd care to repeat.
And wearing makeup.
But I wasn't transgender.
They're always trying to get in touch with their friends.
I wasn't a teenage girl with a boy's body.
They're like, and I'm like, ew. And they're like,
how in the world can I advise my daughter on an experience I never had?
And we're talking about teenage girls or just teenagers.
I decided to ask some experts for help.
How is high school going?
It's going well. I'm stealth, so nobody knows, and I kind of like it that way, because I kind of just want to be viewed as a normal teenage girl, and not here comes the transgender walking down the hallway. It's not bad, but I don't want to be known just for that.
So nobody knows?
Yeah, no one.
Even your good friends?
Yeah, they don't know. I would, be, afraid, that they would, talk about it, in front of, other people, who don't know, and then, it would get, sort of, spread around into, a rumor all around, the whole school, and, yeah, I just don't want that to happen.
So you feel like if you even told one friend, it would probably get out around, and everyone would know?
Yeah, probably.
Can I ask you about dating?
Yeah, sure. So, dating, just in general, when I talk to cis people, they talk about how difficult it is. But I'm like, shut up. You don't even know the half of it. I've had positive responses from some cis people who have just said, I don't care, what body parts you have, I am attracted to you. And as far as negative responses, lashing out or silence, I think my most negative one, it was over text message. So it was just emotional vomiting on me.
That must be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell me about your friendships?
My friendships now are very nice. My initial friends who came with me through my transition, we became much, much closer because I had all girlfriends. And so now I could have identified with everything they were saying. We could all go dress shopping. We could change clothes because, we're all the same size. And it was so nice. So
you've been hanging out with them, but as with a boy identity.
Yeah.
And so now you could be one of the girls.
Yeah. So now I'm being myself and I'm able to communicate much better. We have a much closer friendship. We're all sisters. So yeah, it's really nice.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
That was Marlo Mack, getting advice from transgender teen girls. It's an excerpt from her podcast, How to Be a Girl, a collaboration with KUOW. You can listen to the whole episode and subscribe to How to Be a Girl wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Patricia Murphy in for Bill Radke. Late last month, after 4 years of court battles, the Nooksack tribe near Bellingham removed 306 people, the so-called Nooksack 306, from its tribal rolls. It's called disenrollment, but that fight isn't over. Gabe Galanda is the attorney for the Nooksack 306. He lives here in Seattle, but he's a member of the Round Valley tribe in California. He remembers learning about his native heritage from his grandma and his great-grandma.
In a smoky, gravelly voice, telling me, you're Nomlakian Kong Kao, you're Nomlakian Kong Kao, you're Nomlakian Kong Kao.
But that didn't mean much to him as a kid. Then he became an attorney, working largely with Native clients and tribes on the West Coast. Galanda told Jeannie Yandel, taking the Nooksack disenrollment case has pushed him to ask some hard questions about tribal law and identity.
In 2012, if you'd asked Gabe Galanda about disenrollment, he probably would have said that it can be a heartbreaking process, but tribal governments have the right to decide who's a member and who isn't. Back then, he was getting phone calls from a woman who was part of the Nooksack 306, asking if he'd represent them in their own case against disenrollment. He'd always referred her to other attorneys, but her last call to him was different.
And she got, she says, brother, I need your help. And I remember immediately being taken by how she approached me. And you know, people say, oh, brother, sister, these days, kind of in a way that almost sounds cheesy, but there was a conviction about her voice that kind of grabbed me immediately.
He invited her and other representatives of the 306 to meet with him.
And these people passed the tribal smell test, the way they behaved, the way they talked. But it was so obvious to me that they are Nooksack, that they were Nooksack. And it's been obvious to me ever since. And I was really kind of taken by them in a way that made me appreciate, very simply at the time, because I did not have the full appreciation I have now, but what it means to be a citizen and what it means to have that right stripped, kind of legal. I didn't have the legal sense of that at the time. I fundamentally knew upon first impression that what was happening to them, meaning if someone was telling them they were not tribal or that they don't belong or that they should be disenrolled, was wrong.
So Gabe Galanda agreed to represent the Nooksack 306 in their fight against disenrollment.
And I didn't have any idea what that meant. I had no idea it would be years of litigation with no end in sight, federal court litigation, federal administrative court litigation, multiple tribal court lawsuits, tribal court of appeals controversies. I had no idea. I just thought here and now they need help, and I would apply, as of then, the craft that I had learned for the prior 13 years as a litigator to help them and see where it took us.
At the time, Galanda also didn't know this case would take him into an investigation of why disenrollment exists and where it came from in the first place. In the 1930s, the U.S. government helped many tribes set up constitutions that included language of membership, not citizenship. And there's a big difference between a member and a citizen.
And member, of course, connotes country club, not government. But nonetheless, the United States suggested tribes were membership organizations. And that could be bestowed upon somebody, meaning membership by a tribe. It also could be taken away by the tribe.
Gabe Galanda says he can't find any tribal traditions of disenrollment. And he now believes disenrollment grew out of a centuries-old body of federal law designed to exterminate Native Americans. But many Native people still think the way Gabe Galanda used to, that tribes should have the right to disenroll people. So when Gabe Galanda talks with them, he'll often ask how to say the word disenrollment in their native language.
Is there a word, to the extent you still know your language, that suggests or even connotes disenrollment? The answer is always no. There's no word in traditional dialect or language that equates to disenrollment, which just exclaims my point. This is not an indigenous way. It is not a traditional way. This is a way of termination that's introduced by the United States upon us.
Why then do you think so many tribal leadership organizations believe that they can disenroll members and that that's something, that's a function that they should be providing in order to protect resources, in order to ensure the legacy or the survival of the tribe overall?
I'm not convinced that tribal leadership organizations nationally believe any longer that disenrollment is an inherent sovereign right. I think until the last couple years, there was great miseducation within Indian country about fundamentally what it means to be a citizen and then also what it means to disenroll somebody and about the difference in terms of origin of those two roles or dynamics, the difference in the legality or illegality of those two things. So I would say that Indian country has been uneducated or miseducated about disenrollment for sure and also what it means to have citizens and to bestow citizenship as a government and then ultimately to attempt to remove that citizenship or to take somebody off of the rolls.
Why doesn't a tribal leadership organization, a tribal council, why don't they, in your eyes, have the right to decide who gets to benefit from being part of that tribe and who doesn't?
They certainly have the right to decide who is part of a tribe, but I would suggest that the ways that is being decided is just as colonial and non-Indigenous in nature as disenrollment. So if you are using roles as your quote-unquote base roles from the late 1800s that were generated by the United States, and history has proven were wildly inaccurate, as the means to define who belongs, then are you acting in a self-determinative way? Or are you acting in a conquered way? If you are using blood quantum, which was introduced in the 1930s, along with membership and disenrollment, to decide who belongs, again, are you acting in a self-determinative way, or are you acting in a colonized way? And I'm suggesting that there are healthier, more holistic, more traditional ways than using federal devices of termination and assimilation to decide who belongs. Somebody in my tribe decided that I belonged and that I was a tribal member, and I believe that is my absolute right to be a tribal member. So I disagree with anybody taking it away from me. But if a group of tribal politicians is going to take away somebody's birthright, then at a minimum, they should afford that person due process, equal protection, and a remedy at law. And unfortunately, what is not happening in Indian country is those things are not being afforded. And the absolute right of Indigenous peoples to belong, and that's under international human rights laws, that's under tribal court decisions, it's been deemed an absolute right. It absolutely should not be taken from somebody without some legal recourse. As one tribal court put it, it is taking an Indian person's everything from them. To me, it is a form of identity theft. You are stealing from somebody their self-identification as a tribal member. And to some, the only safety net they have in life is being tribal, is to have some place to belong, some place to go, some place where when the going gets even rougher, they have a place to call home. If you steal somebody's identity, and with that, it typically means you have exiled them from their lands, meaning if I was disenrolled, I would be exiled from the place where I met my great-grandma or my family has land holdings. You cut that safety net out from under them.
So today, 4 years after that phone call where the Nooksack woman called him brother, Gabe Galanda says he has a new understanding of what it means to be Indian.
You are not Indian because a certain quantum of your blood can be tracked back to some ancestor. You're not Indian because your ancestor appeared on some federal roll or census from the late 1800s or early 1900s. But fundamentally, you're Indian because you were taught by other Indian people, namely people like your grandma or your great-grandma, that you were Indian. And it's very simple. If you ask Native Americans questions like you've asked me, how did you first know you're Indian? Rest assured, the way they'll answer the question is because I was told I was.
That new understanding is part of why Gabe Galanda says he's on a crusade now against disenrollment.
I believe disenrollment is wrong. I'm categorically opposed to disenrollment. I believe it is contributing to the demise and termination of Indian people by federal design. In fact, it's horrific to think that what we have survived for two centuries or more in terms of federal attempts to terminate Indian people, we are now doing to ourselves with the same devices that the United States wielded against Indian peoples to extinguish us. So I think about belonging and citizenship and disenrollment each and every day of my life, in large part because of the lives that I'm defending, and defending those livelihoods and those existences is not something I take lightly. In fact, it is something that has taken tremendous emotional and spiritual tolls on me from time to time, but it's also something that I draw great inspiration from. So each and every day I think about these issues, I'm challenged by these issues, and I personally strive to end the injustice that I think is disenrollment, or at least stem it in a very significant way.
Gabe Galanda is an attorney representing the Nooksack 306. Those are 306 people who the Nooksack tribal government is disenrolling. Gabe Galanda spoke with Jeannie Yandel. We reached out to the Nooksack tribe about this interview. They declined to comment.
I
Ah, Bing Crosby. It seems like his voice is everywhere this time of year. But KUOW's Amanda Wild argues Crosby is part of the same musical pantheon as Jimi Hendrix and Kurt Cobain. All three artists came out of Washington State, built their careers during economic booms, and all three were musical game changers. Wild told Jeannie Yandel how Bing Crosby redefined what it meant to be a star and then used that star power to change music technology.
He was the first real media superstar in films, in radio, which he was on for over 30 years. He won awards for his film work, you know, as well as his singing. He also invented a certain style of singing that we now know as crooning. And he did that partially by using brand new technology of the microphone. He used it in a way that we really don't know how it was intended to be used, but certainly not the way he used it. And it was a big success for him. Also, he really boosted the use of magnetic tape, which became a standard in the industry. Before Bing Crosby, shows were all done live, and he wanted to pre-record his show because it was really getting in the way of his golfing and horse racing. So what they did at first was to record the show on these giant wax discs, which cannot be changed. So when he gave money to the Ampex Corporation to help boost projects that had to do with magnetic tape, he became the first show recorded by magnetic tape, and suddenly tape was flexible and you could edit it and change it and move it around. And that was the first time that happened. So that was a huge leap forward, and it became the standard in the industry.
It's also important to note that Bing Crosby, and this is one of the reasons you're looking at him and his work and his life, he's from Washington State. What's his connection to this place?
Well, he was born in Tacoma, but soon after moved with his big family to Spokane. His father built a house there. And what connects all these artists is that they all came out of these big boom periods in our state. So economically, Spokane was flourishing at this time, and there were millionaires living there, which led to a boost in parks and libraries and the arts. And Bing was part of all of that culture growing up, the sort of upward and onward and moving into new places and being adventuresome.
Amanda, I'm going to be honest with you, and I am not sure how to segue between Bing Crosby and the next artist that you've been looking at from Washington State, Jimi Hendrix.
Well, here's a good segue for you. Bing Crosby invented that magnetic tape, and then 30 years later, in another boom period in Seattle, Washington, Jimi Hendrix turned that all on its head. He not only played his guitar upside down, he turned the whole recording process upside down by turning all the amplifiers up to 10, which they were not supposed to really perform at. So he got this new sound that was drenched in feedback and distortion, and he made that work musically. Let's just take probably his most famous song, Purple Haze. I still hear this around Seattle all the time, just where I shop, where I go.
Excuse me while I kiss the sky.
We are proud to be the birthplace of Jimi Hendrix. So take this song, Purple Haze, and you'll hear that Hendrix setting, as they call it, the above 10 setting of everything. And he did it so brilliantly. And he definitely became a symbol for a generation, you know, the generation we know now as the boomers. That generation at that time was questioning, and he was questioning, too, it through his music. You know, what is up and down? What's right and wrong? What's noise? What's music?
Where do you think we hear Jimi Hendrix's upbringing here in the Seattle area in his music?
Well, he went to some of the most diverse schools in the country at the time. And so I think his upbringing here made him that sort of everyman that he is. I don't think people think of Jimi Hendrix, for instance, as a black musician, which is kind of interesting in our highly charged culture right now, you know, but he's never been looked at that way. He's masculine, he's feminine, he's Indian, he's white, he's black. And even though he was aloof in a certain way, he brought this passion to the stage, and that's what made him relatable.
So, Amanda, the last artist that you're looking at from Washington State right now is Kurt Cobain, the frontman for Nirvana. Why him?
So Kurt Cobain, I think, really picked up the pieces of Jimi Hendrix's smash guitar and sort of put something else together and made a new sound. And that's how he became the face of grunge music. And it was also in a boom period, but he was growing up in Aberdeen, a town that was just deteriorating and deteriorating. So it's almost like the rural antithesis of the boom period when you look at his musical reaction to that. You know, he was part of the whole loser era of music.
That's interesting. Kurt Cobain was very upfront about not liking his hometown, Aberdeen. Where do you see Aberdeen show up in his music, though?
Well, he said Aberdeen was like Twin Peaks without the excitement. But I think the reason he got really, really into punk music. Iggy Pop was his idol. That hard edge music was his reaction to living in this really stagnant place. So I think it shows up everywhere in his music. What he did with Nirvana so brilliantly is that they sort of took that hard edge, but they also sneaked in this pop aesthetic, and it made it really universal. A lot of people heard it and could hear the musical part of that hard rock, you know, punk sound.
Where do you see Kurt Cobain and Nirvana's innovation when it comes to technology and music?
He was like a junkmeister. I mean, he played junk, he wore junk. He, you know, the song Polly is done on a guitar that he said he got in a junk shop and barely kept it in tune and had to tape the, you know, tuning keys to keep it where it was. But that's exactly that junky sort of out of tune thing is what's so genuine and authentic about his music. So I think it still attracts us today. It's really hard too, I think, to get in a recording that feel of something live. And I think the people that Nirvana recorded with were able to capture that really well. Some of our local producers were in on that, on Bleach and then on Nevermind, which was, of course, the groundbreaking world hit.
Well, you said that all three of these artists, Bing Crosby, Jimi Hendrix, and Kurt Cobain, they all created during economic boom times. We're in an economic boom right now here in Seattle. Do you think that there's an artist who will be the next one of those, the next kind of game changer artist?
I think it's quite likely, but I'm not going to be able to say who that is, not because I'm hiding anything, but because, you know, the presentation I do looks at the 20th century. And being where we are in time, that gives me some historical perspective. And I just don't think we have the historical perspective right now to, you can predict, but you can't really know. You know, in 20 years, even, we'll be able to see that. I would say, you know, some of the artists coming out of Washington State now have changed how we do things. Like Macklemore has really changed music distribution, for example. Jimi Hendrix changed poster art. So I think we can see some parallels, but as far as lasting impact, I think it takes some time in between to be able to look back and see what that was.
Amanda Wild is the host of KUOW's The Swing Years and Beyond, which airs Saturdays at 7 p.m. Her study of Washington State's music pioneers is part of Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau. She talked with Jeannie Andel. I'm Patricia Murphy. Thanks for joining us for The Record.